What fruits have come our way? What gratitude has he shown us? Say no more, answered Sir Pespian. But look, here comes one to fetch us to the king's tent. When they reached Miraz's tent, they saw Edmund and his two companions seated outside it and being entertained with cakes and wine, having already delivered the challenge and withdrawn while the king was considering it. When they saw them thus at close quarters, the two Telmarine lords thought all three of them very alarming. Inside they found Miraz, unarmed and finishing his breakfast. His face was flushed and there was a scowl on his brow. There! He growled, flinging the parchment across the table to them. See what a pack of nursery tales our jackanapes of a nephew has sent us. By your leave, sire, said Glozell, if the young warrior whom we have just seen outside is the King Edmund mentioned in the writing, then I would not call him a nursery tale, but a very dangerous knight. King Edmund, pah, said Miraz. Does your lordship believe those old wives' fables about Peter and Edmund and the rest? I believe my eyes, your majesty, said Glozell. Well, this is to no purpose, said Miraz, but as touching the challenge, I suppose there is only one opinion between us. I suppose so indeed, sire, said Glozell. And what is that? Asked the king. Most infallibly to refuse it, said Glozell, for though I have never been called a coward, I must plainly say that to meet that young man in battle is more than my heart would serve me for. And if, as is likely, his brother, the High King, is more dangerous than he, why, on your life, my Lord King, have nothing to do with him. Plague on you, cried Miraz. It was not that sort of counsel I wanted. Do you think I am asking you if I should be afraid to meet this Peter, if there is such a man? Do you think I fear him? I wanted your counsel of the policy of the matter, whether we, having the advantage, should hazard it on a wager of battle. To which I can only answer, your majesty, said Glozell, that for all reasons the challenge should be refused. There is death in the strange knight's face. There you are again, said Miraz, now thoroughly angry. Are you trying to make it appear that I am as great a coward as your lordship? Your majesty may say your pleasure, said Glozell sulkily. You talk like an old woman, Glozell, said the king. What say you, my lord Sir Pespian? Do not touch it, sire, was the reply, and what your majesty says of the policy of the thing comes in very happily. It gives your majesty excellent grounds for a refusal, without any cause for questioning your majesty's honour or courage. Great heaven! Exclaimed Miraz, jumping to his feet. Are you also bewitched today? Do you think I'm looking for grounds to refuse it? You might as well call me a coward to my face. The conversation was going exactly as the two lords wished, so they said nothing. I see what it is, said Miraz, after staring at them as if his eyes would start out of his head. You are as lily-livered as hares yourselves, and have the effrontery to imagine my heart after the likeness of yours. Grounds for a refusal, indeed. Excuses for not fighting. Are you soldiers? Are you Telmarines? Are you men? And if I do refuse it, as all good reasons of captaincy and martial policy urge me to do, you will think and teach others to think I was afraid. Is it not so? No man of your majesty's age, said Glozell, would be called coward by any wise soldier for refusing the combat with a great warrior in the flower of his youth. So I'm to be a dotard, with one foot in the grave as well as a dastard, roared Miraz. I'll tell you what it is, my lords, with your womanish counsels, ever shying from the true point, which is one of policy, you have done the very opposite of your intent. I had meant to refuse it, but I'll accept it, do you hear? Accept it! I'll not be shamed because some witchcraft or treason has frozen both your bloods. We beseech your majesty, said Glozell, but Miraz had flung out of the tent, and they could hear him bawling out his acceptance to Edmund. The two lords looked at one another and chuckled quietly. I knew he'd do it if he were properly chafed, said Glozell, but I'll not forget he called me coward. It shall be paid for. There was a great stirring at Aslan's How when the news came back and was communicated to the various creatures. Edmund, with one of Miraz's captains, had already marked out the place for the combat, and ropes and stakes had been put round it. Two Telmarines were to stand at two of the corners, and one in the middle of one side as marshals of the lists. Three marshals for the other two corners, and the other side were to be furnished by the High King. Peter was just explaining to Caspian that he could not be one because his right to the throne was what they were fighting about, when suddenly a thick, sleepy voice said,
"Your Majesty, please."
Peter turned, and there stood the eldest of the Bulgy Bears.
"If you please, Your Majesty," he said, "I am a bear, I am."
"To be sure, so you are, and a good bear too, I don't doubt," said Peter.
"Yes," said the bear, "but it was always a right of the bears to supply one marshal of the lists." "Don't let him," whispered Trumpkin to Peter. "He's a good creature, but he'll shame us all. He'll go to sleep, and he will suck his paws, in front of the enemy too."
"I can't help that," said Peter, "because he's quite right. The bears had that privilege. I can't imagine how it has been remembered all these years when so many other things have been forgotten."
"Please, Your Majesty," said the bear.
"It is your right," said Peter, "and you shall be one of the marshals, but you must remember not to suck your paws."
"Oh, of course not," said the bear in a very shocked voice. "Why, you're doing it this minute,"
bellowed Trumpkin. The bear whipped his paw out of his mouth and pretended he hadn't heard.
"Sire!"
came a shrill voice from near the ground. "Ah, Reepy Cheep," said Peter, after looking up and down and round, as people usually did when addressed by the mouse.
"Sire, my life is ever at your command, but my honour is my own. Sire, I have among my people the only trumpeter in Your Majesty's army. I had thought perhaps we might have been sent with the challenge. Sire, my people are grieved. Perhaps if it were your pleasure that I should be a marshal of the lists, it would content them."
A noise not unlike thunder broke out from somewhere overhead at this point, as Giant Wimbleweather burst into one of those not very intelligent laughs to which the nicer sorts of giant are so liable. He checked himself at once and looked as grave as a turnip by the time Reepy Cheep discovered where the noise came from. "I'm afraid it would not do," said Peter very gravely. "Some humans are afraid of mice."
"I had observed it, sire," said Reepy Cheep.
"And it would not be quite fair to Miraz," Peter continued, "to have in sight anything that might abate the edge of his courage."
"Your Majesty is the mirror of honour,"
said the mouse with one of his admirable bows,
"and on this matter we have but a single mind. I thought I heard someone laughing just now. If anyone present wishes to make me the subject of his wit, I am very much at his service, with my sword, whenever he has leisure."
An awful silence followed this remark, which was broken by Peter saying, "Giant Wimbleweather and the bear and the centaur Glenstorm shall be our marshals. The combat will be at 2 hours after noon. Dinner at noon precisely." "I say," said Edmund as they walked away, "I suppose it is all right. I mean, I suppose you can beat him."
"That's what I'm fighting him to find out," said Peter.
Chapter 14. How All Were Very Busy. A little before 2 o'clock, Trumpkin and the Badger sat with the rest of the creatures at the wood's edge, looking across at the gleaming line of Miraz's army, which was about 2 arrow shots away. In between, a square space of level grass had been staked for the combat. At the 2 far corners stood Glozell and Sopespian with drawn swords. At the near corners were Giant Wimbleweather and the Bulgy Bear, who, in spite of all their warnings, was sucking his paws and looking, to tell the truth, uncommonly silly. To make up for this, Glenstorm, on the right of the lists, stock still except when he stamped a hind foot occasionally on the turf, looked much more imposing than the Telmarine Baron who faced him on the left. Peter had just shaken hands with Edmund and the Doctor, and was now walking down to the combat. It was like the moment before the pistol goes at an important race, but very much worse.
"I wish Aslan had turned up before it came to this," said Trumpkin.
"So do I," said Truffle Hunter. "But look behind you."
"Crows and crockery," muttered the dwarf as soon as he had done so. "What are they?" "Huge people, beautiful people like gods and goddesses and giants. Hundreds and thousands of them closing in behind us. What are they?"
"It's the Dryads and the Hamadryads and Sylvans," said Truffle Hunter. "Aslan has wakened them."
"Humph," said the dwarf. "That'll be very useful if the enemy try any treachery, but it won't help the High King very much if Miraz proves handier with his sword."
The badger said nothing, for now Peter and Miraz were entering the lists from opposite ends, both on foot, both in chain shirts, with helmets and shields. They advanced till they were close together. Both bowed and seemed to speak, but it was impossible to hear what they said. Next moment, the two swords flashed in the sunlight. For a second, the clash could be heard, but it was immediately drowned because both armies began shouting like crowds at a football match.
"Well done, Peter! Oh, well done!"
shouted Edmund as he saw Miraz reel back a whole pace and a half.
"Follow it up quick!"
And Peter did, and for a few seconds it looked as if the fight might be won. But then Miraz pulled himself together, began to make real use of his height and weight.
"Miraz! Miraz! The king! The king!"
came the roar of the Telmarines. Caspian and Edmund grew white with sickening anxiety.
"Peter is taking some dreadful knocks," said Edmund.
"Hello," said Caspian. "What's happening now?"
"Both falling apart," said Edmund. "A bit blown, I expect. Watch! Ah! Now they're beginning again, more scientifically this time. Circling round and round, feeling each other's defences."
"I'm afraid this Miraz knows his work," muttered the doctor.
But hardly had he said this when there was such a clapping and baying and throwing up of hoods among the old Narnians that it was nearly deafening.
"What was it? What was it?" asked the doctor. "My old eyes missed it."
"The High King has pricked him in the armpit," said Caspian, still clapping, "just where the armhole of the hauberk let the point through. First blood."
"It's looking ugly again now, though," said Edmund. "Peter's not using his shield properly. He must be hurt in the left arm."
It was only too true. Everyone could see that Peter's shield hung limp. The shouting of the Telmarines redoubled.
"You've seen more battles than I," said Caspian. "Is there any chance now?"
"Precious little," said Edmund. "I suppose he might just do it. With luck."
"Oh, why did we let it happen at all?" said Caspian.
Suddenly all the shouting on both sides died down. Edmund was puzzled for a moment. Then he said,
"Oh, I see. They both agreed to a rest. Come on, Doctor. You and I may be able to do something for the High King."
They ran down to the lists, and Peter came outside the ropes to meet them, his face red and sweaty, his chest heaving.
"Is your left arm wounded?" asked Edmund.
"It's not exactly a wound," Peter said. "I got the full weight of his shoulder on my shield, like a load of bricks, and the rim of the shield drove into my wrist. I don't think it's broken, but it might be a sprain. If you could tie it up very tight, I think I could manage."
While they were doing this, Edmund asked anxiously,
"What do you think of him, Peter?"
"Tough," said Peter, "very tough. I have a chance if I can keep him on the hop till his weight and short wind come against him. In this hot sun, too. To tell the truth, I haven't much chance else. Give my love to everyone at home, Ed, if he gets me. Here he comes into the lists again. So long, old chap. Goodbye, Doctor. And I say, Ed, say something specially nice to Trumpkin. He's been a brick."
Edmund couldn't speak. He walked back with the doctor to his own lines, with a sick feeling in his stomach. But the new bout went well. Peter now seemed to be able to make some use of his shield, and he certainly made good use of his feet. He was almost playing Tig with Miraz now, keeping out of range, shifting his ground, making the enemy work.
"Coward!" booed the Telmarines. "Why don't you stand up to him? Don't you like it, eh? Thought you'd come to fight, not dance. Yeah!"
"Oh, I do hope he won't listen to them," said Caspian.
"Not he," said Edmund. "You don't know him."
"Oh!"
For Miraz had got in a blow at last on Peter's helmet. Peter staggered, slipped sideways, and fell on one knee. The roar of the Telmarines rose like the noise of the sea. "Now, Miraz!" they yelled. "Now, quick, quick, kill him!" But indeed there was no need to egg the usurper on. He was on top of Peter already. Edmund bit his lips till the blood came, as the sword flashed down on Peter. It looked as if it would slash off his head. Thank heavens, it had glanced down his right shoulder. The dwarf-wrought mail was sound and did not break. "Great Scott!" cried Edmund. "He's up again! Peter, go it! Peter!"
"I couldn't see what happened," said the doctor. "How did he do it?" "Grabbed Miraz's arm as it came down," said Trumpkin, dancing with delight. "There's a man for you. Uses his enemy's arm as a ladder. The High King, the High King. Up, old Narnia." "Look," said Truffle Hunter, "Miraz is angry. It is good."
They were certainly at it hammer and tongs now, such a flurry of blows that it seemed impossible for either not to be killed. As the excitement grew, the shouting almost died away. The spectators were holding their breath. It was most horrible and most magnificent. A great shout arose from the old Narnians. Miraz was down, not struck by Peter, but face downwards, having tripped on a tussock. Peter stepped back, waiting for him to rise. "Oh, bother, bother, bother," said Edmund to himself. "Need he be as gentlemanly as all that? I suppose he must. Comes of being a knight and a high king. I suppose it is what Aslan would like. But that brute will be up again in a minute, and then..." But that brute never rose. The Lords Glozell and Sopespian had their own plans ready. As soon as they saw their king down, they leapt into the lists, crying, "Treachery! Treachery! The Narnian traitor has stabbed him in the back while he lay helpless! To arms! To arms! Telmar!" Peter hardly understood what was happening. He saw two big men running towards him with drawn swords. Then the third Telmarine had leapt over the ropes on his left. "To arms, Narnia! Treachery!" Peter shouted. If all three had set upon him at once, he would never have spoken again, but Glozell stopped to stab his own king dead where he lay.
"That's for your insult this morning," he whispered as the blade went home.
Peter swung to face Sopespian, slashed his legs from under him, and, with the back cut of the same stroke, walloped off his head. Edmund was now at his side, crying, "Narnia! Narnia! The lion!" The whole Telmarine army was rushing towards them, but now the giant was stamping forward, stooping low and swinging his club. The centaurs charged. Twang, twang behind, and hiss, hiss overhead came the archery of dwarfs. Trumpkin was fighting at his left. Full battle was joined. "Come back, Reepy-Cheep, you little ass!" shouted Peter. "You'll only be killed. This is no place for mice." But the ridiculous little creatures were dancing in and out among the feet of both armies, jabbing with their swords. Many a Telmarine warrior that day felt his foot suddenly pierced as if by a dozen skewers, hopped on one leg, cursing the pain, and fell as often as not. If he fell, the mice finished him off. If he did not, someone else did. But almost before the old Narnians were really warmed to their work, they found the enemy giving way. Tough-looking warriors turned white, gazed in terror, not at the old Narnians, but on something behind them, and then flung down their weapons, shrieking, "The wood! The wood! The end of the world!" But soon neither their cries nor the sound of weapons could be heard any more. For both were drowned in the ocean-like roar of the awakened trees as they plunged through the ranks of Peter's army and then on in pursuit of the Telmarines. Have you ever stood at the edge of a great wood on a high ridge when a wild southwester broke over it in full fury on an autumn evening? Imagine that sound. And then imagine that the wood, instead of being fixed to one place, was rushing at you, and was no longer trees, but huge people, yet still like trees, because their long arms waved like branches, and their heads tossed and leaves fell round them in showers. It was like that for the Telmarines. It was a little alarming, even for the Narnians. In a few minutes, all Miraz's followers were running down to the great river in the hope of crossing the bridge to the town of Biruna and there defending themselves behind ramparts and closed gates. They reached the river, but there was no bridge. It had disappeared since yesterday. The utter panic and horror fell upon them, and they all surrendered. But what had happened to the bridge? Early that morning, after a few hours' sleep, the girls had woken to see Aslan standing over them and to hear his voice saying, "We will make holiday." They rubbed their eyes and looked round them. The trees had all gone, but could still be seen moving away toward Aslan's hall in a dark mass. Bacchus and the Maenads, his fierce madcap girls, and Silenus were still with them. Lucy, fully rested, jumped up. Everyone was awake, everyone was laughing. Flutes were playing, cymbals clashing. Animals, not talking animals, were crowding in upon them from every direction.
"What is it, Aslan?" said Lucy, her eyes dancing and her feet wanting to dance.
"Come, children," said he, "ride on my back again today."
"Oh, lovely," cried Lucy,
and both girls climbed onto the warm golden back, as they had done no one knew how many years before. Then the whole party moved off, Aslan leading, Bacchus and his Maenads leaping, rushing and turning somersaults, the beasts frisking round them, and Silenus and his donkey bringing up the rear. They turned a little to the right, raced down a steep hill, and found the long bridge of Biruna in front of them. Before they had begun to cross it, however, up out of the water came a great, wet, bearded head, larger than a man's, crowned with rushes. It looked at Aslan, and out of its mouth a deep voice came.
"Hail, Lord," it said, "loose my chains."
"Who on earth is that?" whispered Susan. "I think it's the river god, but hush," said Lucy.
"Bacchus," said Aslan, "deliver him from his chains."
"That means the bridge, I expect," thought Lucy.
And so it did. Bacchus and his people splashed forward into the shallow water, and a minute later the most curious things began happening. Great strong trunks of ivy came curling up all the piers of the bridge, growing as quickly as a fire grows, wrapping the stones round, splitting, breaking, separating them. The walls of the bridge turned into hedges gay with hawthorn for a moment, and then disappeared as the whole thing, with a rush and a rumble, collapsed into the swirling water. With much splashing, screaming and laughter, the revellers waded or swam or danced across the ford. "Hooray! It's the ford of Biruna again now!" cried the girls, and up the bank on the far side and into the town. Everyone in the streets fled before their faces. The first house they came to was a school, a girls' school where a lot of Narnian girls, with their hair done very tight and ugly tight collars round their necks and thick, tickly stockings on their legs, were having a history lesson. The sort of history that was taught in Narnia under Miraz's rule was duller than the truest history you ever read, and less true than the most exciting adventure story.
"If you don't attend, Gwendolyn," said the mistress, "and stop looking out of the window, I shall have to give you an order mark."
"But please, Miss Prizzle," began Gwendolyn.
"Did you hear what I said, Gwendolyn?" asked Miss Prizzle.
"But please, Miss Prizzle," said Gwendolyn, "there's a lion."
"Take two order marks for talking nonsense," said Miss Prizzle. "And now?"
A roar interrupted her. Ivy came curling in at the windows of the classroom. The walls became a mass of shimmering green, and leafy branches arched overhead where the ceiling had been. Miss Prizzle found she was standing on grass in a forest glade. She clutched at her desk to steady herself and found that the desk was a rose bush. Wild people, such as she had never even imagined, were crowding round her. Then she saw the lion, screamed and fled, and with her fled her class, who were mostly dumpy, prim little girls with fat legs. Gwendolyn hesitated.
"You'll stay with us, sweetheart," said Aslan.
"Oh, may I? Thank you, thank you," said Gwendolyn.
Instantly, she joined hands with two of the Maenads, who whirled her round in a merry dance and helped her take off some of the unnecessary and uncomfortable clothes that she was wearing. Wherever they went in the little town of Beruna, it was the same. Most of the people fled, a few joined them. When they left the town, they were a larger and a merrier company. They swept on across the level fields on the north bank, or left bank, of the river. At every farm, animals came out to join them. Sad old donkeys who had never known joy grew suddenly young again. Chained dogs broke their chains. Horses kicked their carts to pieces and came trotting along with them, clip-clop, kicking up the mud and whinnying. At a well in a yard, they met a man who was beating a boy. The stick burst into a flower in the man's hand. He tried to drop it, but it stuck to his hand. His arm became a branch, his body the trunk of a tree, his feet took root. The boy, who had been crying a moment before, burst out laughing and joined them. At a little town halfway to Beaver's Dam, where two rivers meet, they came to another school, where a tired-looking girl was teaching arithmetic to a number of boys who looked very like pigs. She looked out of the window and saw the divine revellers singing up the street, and a stab of joy went through her heart. Aslan stopped right under the window and looked up at her.
"Oh, don't," she said. "I'd love to, but I mustn't. I must stick to my work, and the children would be frightened if they saw you."
"Frightened?" said the most pig-like of the boys. "Who's she talking to out of the window? Let's tell the inspector she talks to people out of the window when she ought to be teaching us."
"Let's go and see who it is," said another boy, and they all came crowding to the window.
But as soon as their mean little faces looked out, Bacchus gave a great cry of, "Yuan! Yuai! Yai! Yai! Yai!" And the boys all began howling with fright and trampling one another down to get out of the door and jumping out of the windows. And it was said afterwards, whether truly or not, that those particular little boys were never seen again, but that there were a lot of very fine little pigs in that part of the country which had never been there before.
"Now, dear heart," said Aslan to the mistress, and she jumped down and joined them. At Beaver's Dam they recrossed the river and came east again along the southern bank. They came to a little cottage where a child stood in the doorway crying.
"Why are you crying, my love?" asked Aslan.
The child, who had never seen a picture of a lion, was not afraid of him.
"Auntie's very ill," she said. "She's going to die."
Then Aslan went to go in at the door of the cottage, but it was too small for him. So when he had got his head through, he pushed with his shoulders, Lucy and Susan fell off when he did this, and lifted the whole house up, and it fell backwards and apart. And there, still in her bed, though the bed was now in the open air, lay a little old woman who looked as if she had dwarf blood in her. She was at death's door, but when she opened her eyes and saw the bright, hairy head of the lion staring into her face, she did not scream or faint. She said,
"Oh, Aslan, I knew it was true. I've been waiting for this all my life. Have you come to take me away?"
"Yes, dearest," said Aslan. "But not the long journey yet."
And as he spoke, like the flush creeping along the underside of a cloud at sunrise, the colour came back to her white face, and her eyes grew bright, and she sat up and said,
"Why, I do declare, I feel that better. I think I could take a little breakfast this morning."
"Here you are, mother," said Bacchus, dipping a pitcher in the cottage well and handing it to her.
But what was in it now was not water, but the richest wine, red as red-currant jelly, smooth as oil, strong as beef, warming as tea, cool as dew.
"Hey, you've done something to our well," said the old woman. "That makes a nice change, that does."
And she jumped out of bed.
"Ride on me," said Aslan, and added to Susan and Lucy, "You two queens will have to run now."
"But we'd like that just as well," said Susan, and off they went again.
And so, at last, with leaping and dancing and singing, with music and laughter and roaring and barking and neighing, they all came to the place where Miraz's army stood flinging down their swords and holding up their hands, and Peter's army, still holding their weapons and breathing hard, stood round them with stern and glad faces. And the first thing that happened was that the old woman slipped off Aslan's back and ran across to Caspian, and they embraced one another, for she was his old nurse. Chapter 15. Aslan makes a door in the air. At the sight of Aslan, the cheeks of the Telmarine soldiers became the colour of cold gravy, their knees knocked together, and many fell on their faces. They had not believed in lions, and this made their fear greater. Even the red dwarfs, who knew that he came as a friend, stood with open mouths and could not speak. Some of the black dwarfs, who had been of Nicobrick's party, began to edge away. But all the talking beasts surged round the lion with purrs and grunts and squeaks and whinnies of delight, fawning on him with their tails, rubbing against him, touching him reverently with their noses and going to and fro under his body and between his legs. If you have ever seen a little cat loving a big dog whom it knows and trusts, you will have a pretty good picture of their behaviour. Then Peter, leading Caspian, forced his way through the crowd of animals. "This is Caspian, sir," he said, and Caspian knelt and kissed the lion's paw.
"Welcome, prince," said Aslan. "Do you feel yourself sufficient to take up the kingship of Narnia?"
I don't think I do, sir," said Caspian. "I'm only a kid."
"Good," said Aslan. "If you had felt yourself sufficient, it would have been a proof that you were not. Therefore, under us and under the High King, you shall be King of Narnia, Lord of Caer Paravel, and Emperor of the Lone Islands, you and your heirs while your race lasts. And your coronation, but what have we here?"
For at that moment a curious little procession was approaching. 11 mice, 6 of whom carried between them something on a litter made of branches, but the litter was no bigger than a large atlas. No one has ever seen mice more woebegone than these. They were plastered with mud, some with blood too, and their ears were down, and their whiskers drooped, and their tails dragged in the grass, and their leader piped on his slender pipe a melancholy tune. On the litter lay what seemed little better than a damp heap of fur, all that was left of Reepy Cheep. He was still breathing, but more dead than alive, gashed with innumerable wounds, one paw crushed, and where his tail had been, a bandaged stump.
"Now, Lucy," said Aslan.
Lucy had her diamond bottle out in a moment. Though only a drop was needed on each of Reepy Cheep's wounds, the wounds were so many that there was a long and anxious silence before she had finished, and the mouse sprang from the litter. His hand went at once to his sword hilt. With the other he twirled his whiskers. He bowed.
"Hail, Aslan!" came his shrill voice. "I have the honour!"
But then he suddenly stopped. The fact was that he still had no tail, whether that Lucy had forgotten it or that her cordial, though it could heal wounds, could not make things grow again. Reepy Cheep became aware of his loss as he made his bow. Perhaps it altered something in his balance. He looked over his right shoulder, failing to see his tail. He strained his neck further till he had to turn his shoulders, and his whole body followed. But by that time his hindquarters had turned too and were out of sight. Then he strained his neck, looking over his shoulder again, with the same result. Only after he had turned completely round 3 times did he realise the dreadful truth.
"I am confounded," said Reepy Cheep to Aslan. "I am completely out of countenance. I must crave your indulgence for appearing in this unseemly fashion."
"It becomes you very well, small one," said Aslan.
"All the same," replied Reepy Cheep, "if anything could be done, perhaps Her Majesty?"
And here he bowed to Lucy.
"But what do you want with the tail?" asked Aslan.
"Sir,"
said the Mouse. "I can eat and sleep and die for my king without one, but a tail is the honour and glory of a mouse."
"I have sometimes wondered, friend," said Aslan, "whether you do not think too much about your honour."
"Highest of all high kings," said Reepicheep, "permit me to remind you that a very small size has been bestowed on us mice, and if we did not guard our dignity, some, who weigh worth by inches, would allow themselves very unsuitable pleasantries at our expense. That is why I have been at some pains to make it known that no one who does not wish to feel this sword as near to his heart as I can reach shall talk in my presence about traps or toasted cheese or candles. No, sir, not the tallest fool in Narnia."
Here he glared very fiercely up at Wimbleweather, but the giant, who was always a stage behind everyone else, had not yet discovered what was being talked about down at his feet, and so missed the point.
"Why have your followers all drawn their swords, may I ask?" said Aslan.
"May it please your High Majesty," said the second mouse, whose name was Peepicheek. "We are all waiting to cut off our own tails if our chief must go without his. We will not bear the shame of wearing an honour which is denied to the High Mouse."
"Ah!" roared Aslan. "You have conquered me. You have great hearts. Not for the sake of your dignity, Reepicheep, but for the love that is between you and your people, and still more for the kindness your people showed me long ago, when you ate away the cords that bound me on the stone table, and it was then, though you have long forgotten it, that you began to be talking mice. You shall have your tail again."
Before Aslan had finished speaking, the new tail was in its place. Then, at Aslan's command, Peter bestowed the knighthood of the Order of the Lion on Caspian, and Caspian, as soon as he was knighted, himself bestowed it on Truffle Hunter and Trumpkin and Reepicheep, and made Dr. Cornelius his Lord Chancellor, and confirmed the Bulgy Bear in his hereditary office of Marshal of the Lists. And there was great applause. After this, the Telmarine soldiers, firmly but without taunts or blows, were taken across the ford, and all put under lock and key in the town of Baruna, and given beef and beer. They made a great fuss about wading in the river, for they all hated and feared running water, just as much as they hated and feared woods and animals. But in the end, the nuisance was over, and then the nicest parts of that long day began. Lucy, sitting close to Aslan and divinely comfortable, wondered what the trees were doing. At first, she thought they were merely dancing. They were certainly going round slowly in two circles, one from left to right and the other from right to left. Then she noticed that they kept throwing something down in the centre of both circles. Sometimes she thought they were cutting off long strands of their hair. At other times, it looked as if they were breaking off bits of their fingers. But if so, they had plenty of fingers to spare, and it did not hurt them. But whatever they were throwing down, when it reached the ground, it became brushwood or dry sticks. Then three or four of the red dwarfs came forward with their tinder boxes and set light to the pile, which first crackled and then blazed and finally roared as a woodland bonfire on midsummer night ought to do, and everyone sat down in a wide circle round it. Then Bacchus and Silenus and the Maenads began a dance, far wilder than the dance of the trees. Not merely a dance for fun and beauty, though it was that too, but a magic dance of plenty, and where their hands touched and where their feet fell, the feast came into existence. Sides of roasted meat that filled the grove with delicious smells, and wheaten cakes and oaten cakes, honey and many-coloured sugars, and cream as thick as porridge and as smooth as still water, peaches, nectarines, pomegranates, pears, grapes, strawberries, raspberries, pyramids and cataracts of fruit. Then, in great wooden cups and bowls and mazers wreathed with ivy, came the wines, dark, thick ones, like syrups of mulberry juice, and clear red ones, like red jellies liquefied, and yellow wines, and green wines, and yellow-green and greenish-yellow. But for the tree people, different fare was provided.
When Lucy saw Clodsley Shovel and his moles scuffling up the turf in various places, which Bacchus had pointed out to them, and realised that the trees were going to eat earth, it gave her rather a shudder. But when she saw the earths that were actually brought to them, she felt quite different. They began with a rich brown loam that looked almost exactly like chocolate. So like chocolate, in fact, that Edmund tried a piece of it, but he did not find it at all nice. When the rich loam had taken the edge off their hunger, the trees turned to an earth of the kind you see in Somerset, which is almost pink. They said it was lighter and sweeter. At the cheese stage, they had a chalky soil and then went on to delicate confections of the finest gravels powdered with choice silver sand. They drank very little wine, and it made the hollies very talkative. For the most part, they quenched their thirst with deep draughts of mingled dew and rain, flavoured with forest flowers and the airy taste of the thinnest clouds. Thus Aslan feasted the Narnians till long after the sunset had died away and the stars had come out, and the great fire, now hotter but less noisy, shone like a beacon in the dark woods, and the frightened Telmarine saw it from far away and wondered what it might mean. The best thing of all about this feast was that there was no breaking up or going away, but as the talk grew quieter and slower, one after another would begin to nod and finally drop off to sleep, with feet toward the fire and good friends on either side, till at last there was silence all round the circle, and the chattering of water over stone at the ford of Beruna could be heard once more. But all night Aslan and the moon gazed upon each other with joyful and unblinking eyes. Next day, messengers, who were chiefly squirrels and birds, were sent all over the country with a proclamation to the scattered Telmarines, including, of course, the prisoners in Beruna. They were told that Caspian was now king, and that Narnia would henceforth belong to the talking beasts, and the dwarfs, and dryads, and fauns, and other creatures quite as much as to the men. Any who chose to stay under the new conditions might do so, but for those who did not like the idea, Aslan would provide another home. Anyone who wished to go there must come to Aslan and the kings at the ford of Beruna by noon on the fifth day. You may imagine that this caused plenty of head-scratching among the Telmarines. Some of them, chiefly the young ones, had, like Caspian, heard stories of the old days, and were delighted that they had come back. They were already making friends with the creatures. These all decided to stay in Narnia. But most of the older men, especially those who had been important under Miraz, were sulky and had no wish to live in a country where they could not rule the roost. "Live here with a lot of blooming performing animals, no fear," they said. "And ghosts, too," some added with a shudder. "That's what those there dryads really are. It's not canny." They were also suspicious. "I don't trust 'em," they said. "Not with that awful lion and all. He won't keep his claws off us long, you'll see." But then they were equally suspicious of his offer to give them a new home. "Take us off to his den and eat us one by one, most likely," they muttered. And the more they talked to one another, the sulkier and more suspicious they became. But on the appointed day, more than half of them turned up. At one end of the glade, Aslan had caused to be set up two stakes of wood, higher than a man's head, and about 3 feet apart. A third and lighter piece of wood was bound across them at the top, uniting them so that the whole thing looked like a doorway from nowhere into nowhere. In front of this stood Aslan himself, with Peter on his right and Caspian on his left. Grouped round them were Susan, Edmund and Lucy, Trumpkin and Truffle Hunter, the Lord Cornelius, Glenstorm, Reepy Cheep and others. The children and the dwarfs had made good use of the royal wardrobes in what had been the castle of Miraz and was now the castle of Caspian, and what with silk and cloth of gold, with snowy linen glancing through slashed sleeves, with silver mail shirts and jewelled sword hilts, with gilt helmets and feathered bonnets, they were almost too bright to look at. Even the beasts wore rich chains about their necks. Yet nobody's eyes were on them or the children. The living and strokeable gold of Aslan's mane outshone them all. The rest of the old Narnians stood down each side of the glade. At the far end stood the Telmarines. The sun shone brightly, and pennants fluttered in the light wind.
"Men of Telmar," said Aslan, "you who seek a new land, hear my words. I will send you all to your own country, which I know, and you do not."
"We don't remember, Telmar. We don't know where it is. We don't know what it is like," grumbled the Telmarines.
"You came into Narnia out of Telmar," said Aslan. "But you came into Telmar from another place. You do not belong to this world at all. You came hither certain generations ago, out of that same world to which the High King Peter belongs."
At this, half the Telmarines began whimpering.
"There you are, told you so. He's going to kill us all, send us right out of the world."
And the other half began throwing out their chests and slapping one another on the back and whispering,
"There you are. Might have guessed we didn't belong to this place with all its queer, nasty, unnatural creatures. We're of royal blood, you'll see."
And even Caspian and Cornelius and the children turned to Aslan with looks of amazement on their faces.
"Peace," said Aslan in the low voice which was nearest to his growl. The earth seemed to shake a little, and every living thing in the grove became still as stone. "You, Sir Caspian," said Aslan, "might have known that you could be no true king of Narnia unless, like the kings of old, you were a son of Adam and came from the world of Adam's sons. And so you are. Many years ago in that world, in a deep sea of that world which is called the South Sea, a shipload of pirates were driven by storm on an island. And there they did as pirates would, killed the natives and took the native women for wives and made palm wine and drank and were drunk and lay in the shade of the palm trees and woke up and quarrelled and sometimes killed one another. And in one of these frays, six were put to flight by the rest and fled with their women into the centre of the island and up a mountain and went, as they thought, into a cave to hide. But it was one of the magical places of that world, one of the chinks or chasms between worlds in old times, but they have grown rarer. This was one of the last, I do not say the last. And so they fell, or rose, or blundered, or dropped right through, and found themselves in this world, in the land of Telmar, which was then unpeopled. But why it was unpeopled is a long story. I will not tell it now. And in Telmar their descendants lived, and became a fierce and proud people. And after many generations, there was a famine in Telmar, and they invaded Narnia, which was then in some disorder, but that also would be a long story, and conquered it and ruled it. Do you mark all this well, King Caspian?"
"I do indeed, sir," said Caspian. "I was wishing that I came of a more honourable lineage."
"You came of the Lord Adam and the Lady Eve," said Aslan. "And that is both honour enough to erect the head of the poorest beggar and shame enough to bow the shoulders of the greatest emperor on earth. Be content."
Caspian bowed.
"And now," said Aslan, "you men and women of Telmar, will you go back to that island in the world of men from which your fathers first came? It is no bad place. The race of those pirates who first found it has died out, and it is without inhabitants. There are good wells of fresh water, and fruitful soil, and timber for building and fish in the lagoons, and the other men of that world have not yet discovered it. The chasm is open for your return, but this I must warn you, that once you have gone through, it will close behind you forever. There will be no more commerce between the worlds by that door."
There was silence for a moment, Then a burly, decent-looking fellow among the Telmarine soldiers pushed forward and said,
"Well, I'll take the offer."
"It is well chosen," said Aslan, "and because you have spoken first, strong magic is upon you. Your future in that world shall be good. Come forth."
The man, now a little pale, came forward. Aslan and his court drew aside, leaving him free access to the empty doorway of the stakes.
"Go through it, my son," said Aslan, bending towards him and touching the man's nose with his own.
As soon as the lion's breath came about him, a new look came into the man's eyes, startled but not unhappy, as if he were trying to remember something. Then he squared his shoulders and walked through the door. Everyone's eyes were fixed on him. They saw the three pieces of wood, and through them the trees and grass and sky of Narnia. They saw the man between the doorposts. Then, in one second, he had vanished utterly. From the other end of the glade, the remaining Telmarine set up a wailing.
"Oh, what's happened to him? Do you mean to murder us? We won't go that way."
And then one of the clever Telmarines said,
"We don't see any other world through those sticks, if you want us to believe in it. Why doesn't one of you go? All your own friends are keeping well away from the sticks."
Instantly, Reepicheep stood forward and bowed.
"If my example can be of any service, Aslan," he said, "I will take 11 mice through that arch at your bidding without a moment's delay."
"Nay, little one," said Aslan,
laying his velvety paw ever so lightly on Reepicheep's head.
"They would do dreadful things to you in that world. They would show you at fairs. It is others who must lead."
"Come on," said Peter suddenly to Edmund and Lucy. "Our time's up."
"What do you mean?" said Edmund.
"This way," said Susan, who seemed to know all about it. "Back into the trees. We've got to change."
"Change what?" asked Lucy.
"Our clothes, of course," said Susan. "Nice fools we'd look on the platform of an English station in these."
"But our other things are at Caspian's castle," said Edmund.
"No, they're not," said Peter, still leading the way into the thickest wood. "They're all here. They were brought down in bundles this morning. It's all arranged."
"Was that what Aslan was talking to you and Susan about this morning?" asked Lucy.
"Yes, that and other things," said Peter, his face very solemn. "I can't tell it all to you. There were things he wanted to say to Sue and me, because we're not coming back to Narnia."
"Never?"
cried Edmund and Lucy in dismay.
"Oh, you two are," answered Peter, "at least from what he said. I'm pretty sure he means you to get back some day, but not Sue and me. He says we're getting too old."
"Oh, Peter," said Lucy, "what awful bad luck. Can you bear it?"
"Well, I think I can," said Peter. "It's all rather different from what I thought. You'll understand when it comes to your last time. But quick, here are our things."
It was odd and not very nice to take off their royal clothes and to come back in their school things, not very fresh now, into that great assembly. One or two of the nastier Telmarines jeered, but the other creatures all cheered and rose up in honour of Peter the High King and Queen Susan of the Horn and King Edmund and Queen Lucy. There were affectionate and, on Lucy's part, tearful farewells with all their old friends, animal kisses and hugs from bulgy bears, and hands wrung by Trumpkin, and a last tickly, whiskerish embrace with Truffle Hunter. And, of course, Caspian offered the horn back to Susan, and, of course, Susan told him to keep it. And then, wonderfully and terribly, it was farewell to Aslan himself, and Peter took his place with Susan's hands on his shoulders, and Edmund's on hers, and Lucy's on his, and the first of the Telmarines on Lucy's, and so, in a long line, they moved forward to the door. After that came a moment which is hard to describe, for the children seemed to be seeing three things at once. One was the mouth of a cave opening into the glaring green and blue of an island in the Pacific, where all the Telmarines would find themselves the moment they were through the door. The second was a glade in Narnia, the faces of dwarfs and beasts, the deep eyes of Aslan, and the white patches of the badger's cheeks. But the third, which rapidly swallowed up the other two, was the grey, gravelly surface of a platform in a country station, and a seat with luggage round it, where they were all sitting as if they had never moved from it. A little flat and dreary for a moment after all they had been through, but also, unexpectedly, nice in its own way, what with the familiar railway smell and the English sky and the summer term before them.
"Well," said Peter, "we have had a time."
"Bother," said Edmund. "I've left my new torch in Narnia."
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. To order additional cassettes or CDs, or to receive a complete catalog of Harper Audio and Cadman titles, please call us at 1-800-331-3761. You might also try our website, www.harperaudio.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.